The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, and I'm the director of author events here. And as with all jobs, being the director has its bad days and good, but some days are great, and this is one of them. While we've had remarkable scientists here in the past, including E.O. Wilson, Brian Greene, Roger Penrose, James Watson, and in a few weeks, Nobel Prize winner Harold Varmus, we're excited to host a man variously described as, quote, one of the great thinkers of our time, unquote, one of the environmental movement's most influential figures. And for good measure, he has also been named one of the world's top 100 global public intellectuals. Mr. Lovelock's notable contributions to science include the creation of the electron capture detector, with which he was the first to notice the widespread presence of CFCs in the atmosphere, and that eventually led to the global CFC ban. The electron capture detector was also used to discover pesticide residues in all Earth creatures from penguins in the Antarctic to the milk of nursing mothers in the United States. This discovery helped Rachel Carson write Silent Spring and provided her with the evidence that these toxic chemicals were ubiquitous worldwide. Mr. Lovelock originated the Gaia hypothesis, later the Gaia theory, which claims that the Earth and all of its inhabitants make up a living, self-regulating superorganism. And in September 2007, with Chris Rapley, Lovelock proposed the construction of ocean pumps to move water up from below the deep ocean to fertilize algae and the surface waters and encourage them to bloom, with the intention of accelerating the transfer of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere to the ocean. Later this year, he will travel to outer space on Virgin Galactic's Spaceship Two to get an astronaut's view of the big blue marble. But first, he has to discuss his new work, The Vanishing Face of Gaia, with us. Please welcome James Lovelock.
Thank you, Andy, for that generous introduction. And may I also take the opportunity of thanking the Philadelphia Public Library for giving me the pleasure and honor of being here to speak to you tonight. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's now almost 12 years since that grand meeting at Kyoto, which was intended to settle the problem of global heating. In that time, not much has happened, other than the founding of two more meetings, one a few years ago at Bali, and now one due shortly at Copenhagen. It seems to be the way of meetings. They plan and give birth to new ones. And also, not a lot has happened to the climate. We're supposed to be in global heating, but my climatologist friends tell me that the Earth's surface and atmospheric temperatures fell by about a degree Fahrenheit last year and have changed very little since Kyoto. So does this mean that global heating is no more than a green nightmare, and we need no longer fret about our carbon footprints? To find out, I suppose the first thing a sensible person would do would be to go to Google and find what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, has to say about it. Well, as you probably know, it's made up from over 1,000 of the world's best climate scientists. And after their report was issued in 2007, they and Al Gore were rightly awarded a Nobel Peace Prize for their outstanding and unstinted efforts. Importantly, the IPCC still regards climate change as real and potentially deadly, and their findings are taken by world leaders as authoritative, so much so that their predictions are used to frame legislation and policy looking as far as 50 years into the future. The assumption is that global warming is so serious that massive and expensive action is needed now if we're to avoid damaging climate change. The present cool spell, therefore, doesn't seem to give us any reason to suppose that the IPCC has overestimated climate change. And I think instead that they've underestimated it. And mainly because far too much attention has been given to human, industrial and domestic pollutions, and not enough to our planet's response to what we do. We have to understand that the Earth is not a passive planet like its sisters Mars and Venus. It responds more like something that is alive. And the Earth's response, unlike the things that we do, is potentially quite deadly. And because the responses it makes are now happening in the deserts and in the forests of the tropics and on the ocean surface, and most of all in the Arctic, all places all far away from the cities where we live our own controlled environments, we don't notice them. But they bring to me an apocalyptic view of the future, because I see the 6 to 8 billions of us faced with ever-diminishing supplies of food and water in an increasingly intolerable climate. I'm not alone in this grim view of our future, and it's shared by eminent climate scientists such as James Hansen and Stephen Schneider. Well, I think you may well ask, how have we scientists let this potentially disastrous future steal up on us, apparently unawares? Well, there are several reasons, and the first one amongst them, I think, is our success at solving the important but much more manageable problem of stratospheric ozone depletion. I suspect that it gave us false confidence in our ability to deal with the far greater and more complex danger of global heating. And I have a personal anecdote here which I think brings out this point. I was at a meeting in Paris about 2 years ago on climate change, and sitting next to me in the seat was a scientist I thought I knew, and he turned to me and said much the same thing. I know you, don't I? I'm Mario Molina, of course, one of the two of the three Nobel Prize winners for the ozone depletion story. We both agreed that what a pity it was that there weren't just 6 large industrial firms emitting carbon dioxide. How much easier the problem would have been to solve. Another reason for us being caught unawares is the division of science itself into almost unconnected specialties. Climate science is almost wholly concerned with atmospheric physics and chemistry, but the ecosystems of the Earth are almost wholly in the province of biology. And as you probably know, these two great divisions of science don't speak the same language. And this has led to the deplorable separation of the assessment of the Earth's health between two different international scientific bodies, one based on physical science, the IPCC, and the other based on biology, the Millennium Ecology Assessment Commission. Of course, the Earth itself is not so divided, and so long as we treat it as two separate entities, the geosphere for the material Earth and the biosphere for life, we'll fail properly to understand our planet. Now, if it were just a matter of devising a common language for science, we might by now have a true Earth system science or a Gaian approach to climate change. But there is another division that prevents understanding, and that's the old one between theory and practice. The advent of powerful computers by about the middle of the last century has made it ever easier to build apparently realistic simulations of our planet, its climate, and its ecosystems. And it becomes all too tempting to believe that the computer model is the real world, and that the hard down-to-earth effort of gathering data on polar glaciers or in tropical forests is less needed. We should have been warned. The first inexcusable error occurred in the 1980s, when modellers of ozone depletion were so sure that their virtual worlds were real, that they ignored data about CFC abundance in the atmosphere. I know this because at the time I was measuring it, and also about ozone in the stratosphere. Earth-orbiting satellites first saw the ozone hole over Antarctica, but the modellers took it as an instrument error, and it wasn't until two scientists at an Antarctic base looked up into the sky with a simple handheld spectrometer that the ozone hole was first seen. And only then did we realize how serious was ozone depletion. It's interesting that the observers in Antarctica delayed 2 years before publishing a paper on this because they couldn't believe that the models were wrong and they were right. Now, a wholly predicted but equally deadly hole has appeared in the floating ice of the Arctic Ocean. It seems that the lesson has still not been learnt. In earlier times of science, these deficiencies would merely have been part of the natural history of science, but now they seriously interfere with our ability to understand the Earth when we most badly need to do so. We need to understand the consequences of adding greenhouse gases to the air, but just as importantly, we need to understand the consequences of removing natural forests to make ever more farmland. Each of these acts disables the Earth system's capacity to regulate itself. In a way, we're very much like someone who smoked cigarettes for 30 years and now suffers a persistent cough. It's getting rather late to reform. If these climate models, like the IPCs, are unreliable, how can we be sure about the climate 10 years from now, still less at the end of the century? I think the simple answer is that we can't. The failure is so great that the IPCC is even failing to predict what is happening to the climate this year. And this stark view was reinforced 2 years ago by the publication by a group of observers, including the Keelings, who have long measured CO2 on Hawaii, James Hansen, and a German scientist, Ramsdorf. They compared high-quality measurements of mean temperature, sea level, and carbon dioxide, and showed that even the gloomiest predictions of the IPCC were underestimating the severity of the climate change that was actually happening. Now, I have a slide that shows this. Here we are. The straight line on the top of the diagram shows you the sea level rise from 1993 to about 2007. And the actual rise is in millimetres on the scale up there. So we're talking about a rise of about 30 millimetres of sea level over that time, 3 centimetres. Not very much, but as I will shortly tell you, it's quite important. Now, the range of predictions by the IPCC is in the green band shown below. And even the gloomiest of the models, the top one, is failing by a factor of 2 to predict the actual rise of sea level. Now, sea level rise is truly an important quantity because it is, in a way, a true thermometer of what is happening to the Earth. You see, there's only 2 ways the sea level can rise. One is by the ocean warming, and it expands just like a thermometer. And the other is by the melting of ice on the land, which flows, the water then flows down the rivers into the ocean and causes it to rise. Now, both of these are direct measures of the amount of heat the Earth has received, extra heat, that is, as a consequence of global warming. And as you can see, it's steadily going up and up. So if you really want to know what's happening to the Earth, go to Google again and look up sea level and see if it's still rising. It may freeze unexpectedly next year. It means very little because the sea, you see, holds 800 times as much heat as does the surface and atmosphere. And it's the sea that gives you the true answer. possible. Now, this one shows the measurements of the ice hole that I talked about a few moments earlier. And it's expressed as the anomaly, that is, the ice that isn't there in, at the end of the summer, as compared with what it was in 1978. And you can see that by 2007, the ice remaining had fallen to only 40% of all the ice that was originally floating in the North Polar Ocean. And any businessman seeing a graph like that would think it was time to scuttle. Now, the IPCC predictions of what would happen are the little red dots up in the top of the diagram. And you see they were missing out this deep, deep hole almost completely. This is deadly serious stuff because it's reckoned that within 5 to 20 or 30 years, all of the ice floating in the North Polar Ocean will be gone by the end of the summer. So if you're so inclined, you could sail a sailboat to the North Pole where explorers used to tramp with great difficulty years ago. And when that happens, the extra heat that's absorbed from the sun by the dark ocean as compared with that that was reflected by the white ice back into space will cause an addition to the heating of the Earth roughly equal to all of the CO2 we've added to date. In other words, the clearance of that ice completely doubles the amount of heat that the Earth has received. Now, the most likely explanation of this, they're not blunders, because climate scientists are principled and as good as they can be, but they've had to reduce their vision of the Earth to something that can be managed. And so far, they've only had time to come to terms with the gases of the atmosphere. They know that the oceans, the clouds, and the surface are important, but still they only partly understand their effect. The biosphere's response and reaction is almost completely unknown. What we can do in these circumstances is to make a very simple elementary model of the Earth using Gaia theory. And I made one in 1994, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nature. I won't go into the details of it, but what I will do is to show you the predictions of that model, which is of a live Earth, so to speak, compared with the IPCC's predictions for the rest of this century. The solid line is an average of the best of the IPCC's predictions of global warming for this century. It goes from 1900 to 2000 to 2100. And as you can see, the IPCC seems to predict temperatures going remorselessly upwards. And it's a good job we can't see beyond 2100 because they would be going out through the roof by then. The grey oscillating line is the output of the very simple model that I mentioned. And you can see it shows a very, very different picture. It shows variations, which are the amplifications of seasonal changes, and then a sudden jump when 450 parts per million of CO2 are reached in the atmosphere to a new stable state where the temperature stays more or less constant at about 5 degrees higher than now. Now, interestingly, that prediction fits in a lot better with the Earth's history. There was an event 55 million years ago where a similar amount of CO2 was added to the atmosphere that we are adding through a geological accident, and this was much more like the course of things that happened then than is predicted by the IPCC models. Yes, and here is an example of the Earth's history. That's the change in temperature from the last ice age until now. We go back 15,000 years just before the ice age ended, And you can see it ended with a somewhat spiky jump to fairly highish temperatures, and then a fall back to quite low temperatures, and then quite suddenly a precipitous jump up to a new stable state, which is, of course, the interglacial that we were in until we started warming up again. And so we should expect that there will be sudden jumps in temperature before it goes to its stable eventual state. And one of the warning factors here is that a very cold year may be the precursor of the final jump to the hot state. So one should not be put off by imagining that the cold year means that global warming is over. I find it quite extraordinary that my colleagues in climate science could have put their names to predictions as far ahead as the end of the century and in the face of these great uncertainties. I know personally scientists of the IPCC, and some of them are my personal friends, and I know that they're wise, competent, and principled. So what on earth made them persist with what may be the wrong kind of climate model and then assume that their forecasts were good enough for governments to base policy on them? One answer may be that they had no option. Having persuaded government that large and expensive modelling centres, what you might call the battleships of the climate war, were needed, they just had to sail in them and hope for the best. It's complicated further by the fact that government and research agencies are cutting back funds for observations and spend instead on ever more complicated computers and the facilities that go with them. I've lived long enough to see this happen, and I often wonder what a modern grant agency would have done in the early 19th century about funding a graduate student called Charles Darwin, who wanted to travel around the world on a ship and just have a look to see what was happening. I don't think he would have got his funding. Nature is always the final arbiter of our ideas, and they must be tested in the real world. The virtual worlds of models are always hypothetical until the test is made. So what can we do? Of course, we'd better stop burning fossil fuel at an excessive rate, and equally importantly, reduce the area of the natural world we use for ourselves. But our main task, should global heating continue, is to adapt and prepare to survive. The Earth system Gaia has survived far worse insults than anything that we are doing and will almost certainly save itself. We're a tough species and have survived 7 major climate crises in the past 1,000,000 years. And by this I mean the violent moves from ice age to interglacial, as indicated by this sort of thing. So we've been through it, as I say, 7 times in the last 1,000,000 years. We just have to survive global heating and hope that the stresses it imposes will encourage the evolution of a more capable form of human. But in so doing, we may be cut back to 1 billion people or less. So we truly have to concentrate on saving ourselves, and it's false pride, hubris, to think that we can save the planet. Does this mean that there's little we can do to prevent the Earth system moving to a hot, stable state? Perhaps it does, but in no way do I mean there's nothing we can do. There have been a lot of proposals recently to geoengineer the Earth. That means do things that will attempt to stop global warming by engineering means. I'll be glad to answer questions on this topic, but there isn't time now to go into it in any detail, except to say that by far the most promising of these approaches is to use the power of the vegetation of the Earth to pump down CO2 from the air and then prevent the carbon it's captured from returning as it does now. You see, all but 0.1% of the carbon dioxide captured by plants is returned to the air by animals, microorganisms, and of course ourselves as they eat them. Plants on the land and algae in the ocean remove 550,000 million tons of carbon dioxide every year, whereas we are only emitting 33,000 million tons. So the biosphere is doing a far better job than we could ever manage by industrial means. It mayn't be so difficult. At a start, if we could persuade farmers everywhere to turn their waste, the straw and other non-edible plants of their crops, into charcoal, and then either plough the charcoal back into their soil or send it to the oceans for burial, we would then use the Earth system to pump the CO2 from the atmosphere for us. If we could use the ocean as a place for farming, it would be even more effective. And I think the best hope for geoengineering lies in something like that. Perhaps our first task is to stop thinking blindly that reducing our carbon footprint is all that we have to do. It is not. We have to understand that by abrading the skin of our planet to provide farmland, we've destroyed more than 40% of the Earth's natural ecosystems, and it was these that previously served to keep a stable climate. And this picture, which was taken from Science magazine, illustrates my point. It's a simulation of New York on the left-hand side as it was in the 16th century compared with now. Yet the whole Earth has been changed in that sort of way. Where there was wall-to-wall forest, there's now either farmland or cities. And it's not the same planet that it was, and that is half the problem. The present IPCC models, although they underestimate, predict almost unanimously that by 2040, the average summer in the northern temperate regions of the world, that's most of North America, Europe, China, and so on, will be as hot as was the summer of 2003 in Europe, when over 30,000 people died of heat. During that summer, temperatures in June, July, and August were in averaging around about 110 Fahrenheit, and there's no rain. Of course, 30,000 is a small number of all the 200 or 300 million that were in Europe, but that the important thing was that their agricultural production fell to almost zero in that year. In the future, we may be able to cool ourselves with air conditioning and learn to live in a climate no worse than Baghdad now. But without extensive irrigation, the plants will die, and both farming and natural ecosystems will be replaced by scrub and desert. So what will there be to eat? And that's the big problem. And the same dire changes will affect the rest of the world. And I can envisage you here migrating to Canada, the Chinese to Africa or Siberia. But again, will there be enough food for us all? We may have as much as 20 years to prepare for these changes. We can't go on burning fossil fuels, but our cities still need abundant electricity to survive. Apart from hydroelectricity, and perhaps the promise of solar thermal energy from hot desert regions, renewable energy just does not seem to work, and is a pipe dream made profitable by subsidies and tax breaks, but in reality produces little. It's time we admitted that the grand ideas of sustainable development is now, along with most green policies, no more than a romantic dream and probably impossible to achieve. So we must accept nuclear energy as the immediately available, safe, constant and reliable source of energy. Most, if not all, of the objections to it are based on irrational fear, and this has led to unwise legal and political restrictions of its use. It need not be looked on as a long-term solution, but it will surely get us through the next crucial 20 or 30 years. In France, they produce 80% of their electricity from nuclear and the rest from hydroelectricity, and are an example to the world about the right thinking on energy. Perhaps the saddest thing is that if we fail and humans go extinct, Gaia will lose as much or more than we do. Not only will wildlife and whole ecosystems vanish, but in human civilization, the planet has a precious resource. In no way are we a disease of the planet. We are, through our intelligence and communication, the planetary equivalent of a nervous system. So we should not feel guilty. In the Earth's history, there have been other organisms that, in their early development, wreaked havoc on a scale far worse than we've done, yet in time became quite vital components of the Earth system. The photosynthesizers that evolved perhaps 3 billion years ago first released oxygen into the atmosphere and must then have been far worse polluters than we are. You see, oxygen to the early atmosphere was probably as poisonous as it would be to release chlorine into the atmosphere now. Yet over the years, life adapted and then made use of this reactive gas to empower animal life and us, and even let us drive our cars. It's taken Gaia at least 3.5 billion years to evolve an intelligent, partly social animal. The photosynthesizers had a long time to wait before they became trees, and even giant redwood trees. So we have to be patient while we slowly evolve to become an integrated part of what could be an intelligent planet, the first one in our galaxy. But what a wonderful future for us that could be. Thank you.
Mr. Lovelock, thank you for that talk. If you'd like to ask a question, please raise your hand and wait for the mic, and we'll get a mic to you. Gentleman in the yellow back there.
It was quite sobering. Thank you. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that, the ozone issue? 15 years ago, we heard that there were problems with the ozone in Antarctica, and there was a concerted, I think, international effort to cut down on the chemicals that we believe were causing that. Now, has that problem been solved, or are we still dealing with it?
Your question is, has the problem been solved? I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear what the problem was.
Has the problem been solved?
The ozone.
Oh, yes. Has the ozone depletion problem been solved? Not completely. I think there are signs that some of the Asian countries are still going on producing CFCs, but for most purposes it has been solved, and the ozone layer is steadily recovering.
Another question. All the way back, lady in the orange there on our left.
Hi, great talk, thanks. Your recommendation of nuclear energy, is that because we've given up all hope of actually reducing consumption across the globe, energy consumption across the globe? And as ocean levels rise and populations shift and we're cultivating new areas agriculturally or changing our food systems, are we not concerned that there will be some social breakdown that will disrupt people taking care of nuclear waste and ensuring that it doesn't get into the environment? Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, that's an interesting question. There are several questions sort of encompassed in the whole of your statement. Nuclear waste is often said to be a problem. I don't think it is. My wife Sandy and I, who's sitting in the front row, were invited by the French to stand on their store of nuclear waste in the northern part of France at La Hague. They have about 25 years of high-level nuclear waste, and they use more nuclear energy than anybody. And it's stored in a building not a lot larger than this hall. And there's 3 meters of concrete above the material that's dropped into a hole in the granite. And the radiation level above it, as measured by my own handheld monitor, would be about the same as here in Philadelphia, 0.25 microsieverts per hour, utterly harmless. It isn't a problem if you can put all that much nuclear waste in a relatively small hole in the ground from 25 years of electricity production. I don't think it's a problem at all. Yet think, each year, the amount of CO2 that we put into the atmosphere as waste, if it were turned to solid, would make a mountain 1 mile high and 12 miles in circumference. And that waste will kill us all if we don't do something about it.
Welcome to Philadelphia. Thank you for your talk. I'm confused about what you were saying about the charcoal and the notion of the algae, that both of those would mitigate carbon dioxide. And could you go back to that? I was unsure exactly what you were proposing or suggesting.
I must apologize. I did rather slide over that particular point. No, it's that one tends to forget that 70% of the world's surface is ocean, and there is a fair amount of life in it, although less than there used to be. And if we can do ocean farming, as has been suggested by a number of agencies, and then take the waste product of that and convert that to charcoal, drop it to the bottom of the ocean, we will be adding to the total of carbon dioxide we remove from the atmosphere by turning it to charcoal. Perhaps I should explain that charcoal is a bit like gold. It's almost totally unreactive. It can't be biodegraded by organisms, and neither does it react under ordinary conditions with oxygen. So it sits around forever. In fact, you can find charcoal from forest fires 300 million years ago in the sediments.
And gentleman in the blue there.
Thank you for the excellent talk. So I guess could we take the long view on this, like the extremely long view? And if nothing happens, or if the collapse does happen, does the general trend, I think Darwin even said, the general trend towards cephalization, towards increased nervous systems, I mean, does intelligence go away for sure? Why is it an apocalyptic vision? And I guess why is the solution to maintain the status quo by bringing the carbon back into the earth?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that one.
The ultimate question is why?
We're not maintaining the status quo. That's the problem. The amount of carbon dioxide in the air is steadily rising, not because of what we're adding to it only, but because of what the system is adding. You see, just recently in the last year, we've been made aware particularly of that danger as the permafrosts in Siberia and Canada begin to melt at the end of the summer season, and in so doing release carbon dioxide and methane to the atmosphere, something they weren't doing until recently. And as global warming proceeds, the quantity emerging from those regions will steadily increase. The same to an extent is true of the ocean. As the ocean surface warms, it stabilizes, and the top warm layer floats on the nutrient-rich water below so that algae can no longer live in it. Therefore, they can no longer perform their functions of pumping down CO2 from the atmosphere and assisting in the total regulation. Also, they're no longer producing the gas dimethyl sulfide that helps cloud formation and whitens the clouds that are already there. It's factors like that, because of the non-linearity of the system itself, that stop any kind of equilibrium being established.
Why does intelligence go away? Why does intelligence go away? The apocalyptic view.
Well, if we're all dead, then no. I mean, all humans. I think humans are special in this respect. I'm reluctant to say that because I've always been rather against such views, but the fact is, as a socially intelligent animal. Not that any single one of us is particularly bright. We have achieved an awful lot. We've let the planet, for the first time, see itself from space and see through our minds, because we're part of it, just how beautiful it is compared with Mars and Venus, those two great deserts. If you get a little bit more sort of visionary, you can think of a time ahead when we've reached a point and can be part of the defensive system of the planet, become aware of things, for example, asteroidal impacts coming, and try to prevent them. I think we have an immense future in that respect.
Okay, in the blue right here.
Yes, in talking about phenomena that add to our global warming, the melting of the ice caps, thawing of the permafrost, and our continued emissions into the atmosphere, I believe you hypothesized that there may be a stable point coming. Do you know of another natural phenomenon that is occurring that counters these effects?
Yes, in a way. You see, what we're doing is mimicking what happened 55 million years ago, when a very similar quantity of carbon dioxide to that we're releasing was put into the atmosphere by a geological accident. It was actually 2 million million tons of CO2. We put in about 1 million tons so far. What happened was temperatures rose, as that diagram showed you, about 5 degrees, and then stayed constant for 200,000 years before they gradually declined to more normal levels. Interestingly, life was not made extinct. It migrated to the polar regions, which were quite hot. The sea surface temperature of the polar ocean was about 73 Fahrenheit, and crocodiles lived in it. But the rest of the world, below perhaps latitude 50 north, roughly, was scrub and desert.
Lots of questions. Lady in the orange and white here.
You mentioned that there might be a population correction in this view, where the population of people would go from 10 billion to 1 billion. Is that the number that you think would be supportable on the Earth, and what would be the process of bringing that down, since typically the population has tended to want to grow? So what would happen there?
Well, we're seeing it happen, the start of it happening already. It's mainly through thirst and hunger. As the world warms, rainfall can increase, but it doesn't stay put. Water evaporates very rapidly when temperatures rise much above about 24, 25 Celsius. So the desertification is the kind of process that will extend to much of the world. We in Europe are watching it happen now. Southern Spain is becoming Saharan, so is bits of Sicily and Greece, and gradually the Sahara is moving up to take over Europe as it warms up. And as I said, the IPCC predict that by 2040 to 2050, Saharan conditions will extend, apart from mountain regions, as far north perhaps as Berlin.
So is your thought that, 9 million people are going to die of starvation, and that's what's going to bring us from 10 to 1?
No, not only starvation. I fear it'll be the four horsemen. It won't happen without there being wars, pestilence, and so on.
Okay. I've got a good question here. Gentleman in the turquoise all the way back.
How would you produce the charcoal you were discussing earlier? Or how is the charcoal produced?
Right. There's a New York scientist called Johannes Lehmann that first suggested this idea a few years ago. And I think his notion is that it's produced in much the same way as a charcoal burner produces his charcoal. If you take the carbonaceous waste from the farms and just burn it in a tiny amount of oxygen, just enough to heat it up, the rest of the material just, when it gets hot, carbonizes, turns to carbon, and vents off a lot of water and a small amount of biofuel that is a kind of bonus byproduct of the operation. You'd have a sort of steel cylinder on every farm where he put all of his waste and somehow started a fire at one end until it was all charcoal.
So each farm would have a furnace where things would be burned, and then it would be plowed into the ground as an inert substance?
And if you got enough biofuel, which would be very nice, they wouldn't need a subsidy.
Okay. Another question. All the way in back in the orange there.
Thank you for your talk. I don't know if I understood you correctly, but can Gaia theory actually be used to improve on the predictions by the IPCC? And if so, how would they do so?
Can Gaia theory be used to improve climate predictions by the IPCC, and how would that be done?
Not very easily. The models I compared that are used by the IPCC in most of their centers, I compared them to battleships, and really they are in many ways like battleships. And it's not easy to change it and turn a battleship into a submarine or something like that. And in the same way, those class of models cannot easily be changed into the dynamic models you would need to do a simulation of Gaia theory of the Earth in them. In fact, you don't need to make battleships. You can do the simulation in quite small models, and several attempts have been made that look like being successful to do this, but they're not on the scale of the giant models of the IPCC.
Right in the front row here, lady in the front.
Thank you, Mr. Lovelock, for your talk. And in your statement talking about renewable energy, you said that renewable energy doesn't seem to work. You called it a pipe dream made possible by subsidies and a romantic dream. May I ask you why you see no future for solar energy, the cleanest, safest energy available on this planet?
Oh, my remarks do not...
Thank you.
Do not apply to solar thermal energy at all. I think that is a very good way of extracting energy. The problem is that we don't have it yet. It's only talked about. The first prototype plants are being put up in California, New Mexico, Spain, and places, other places where there's continuous sunshine during the daytime. And I think they will work very well. And they have the potential to supply most of the electricity needed by the United States. The problem is we may not have very long, and nuclear energy is available immediately if we get round the rather restrictive legislation. It takes about 3.5 to 4.5 years to build a station if you've got the will to do it, but I'm afraid there's very little will anywhere to do it.
Few more questions. Lady right in the middle here in the multicolored shirt. And then who's got the question after that? Is there another hand? gentleman here in front. We'll move to him.
Thank you. Could you comment on the Three Gorge Dam project and whether you feel that's a good balance for the output over the environmental impact?
I think it's a magnificent engineering achievement on the part of the Chinese and an example of renewable energy that does work. But then I've never considered hydroelectricity included in the sort of my comments on renewable energy. Its main difference is that it's existed for donkey's years. We've always we've used it for a very long time, and it doesn't require subsidies. It pays for itself usually. And the Chinese effort, I think, is magnificent, and they are very well aware in China of the problems they're causing. But still, the world gets nearly all of its electricity from burning coal, and China included, and there just isn't enough in the way of alternatives.
Hi. Have you thought about whether an internet-enabled generation might be able to finally collect enough data points to create an ongoing and continuous climate control model instead of the lack of data that a lot of your supercomputer guys always claim are the error points in the vast grid they predict?
I think you have a very good point there. And indeed, it's already happening. There's a little spin-off program from Google called Earth Browser, and I recommend it. It's not for free. You have to buy it for about $10 or $15, I've forgotten what. But it gives you the all of the weather stations around the world, their temperatures, wind velocities, dew points, everything you need to know, and the forecast for the week that follows. Also, that same program provides the water surface temperatures of buoys out in the ocean. And I find it very interesting that you can go straight today and look at those. The modelers don't see the data that's gathered by the buoys for up to a year or 2 years, because it's all put into a giant data bank, handled by civil servants and parceled out over the course of time. Yes, I agree with you. We should use the internet more. It would be helpful, but I don't think it would need a lot of fine-tuning.
How far above and below the Earth do you have to collect data before you know whether your model is accurate?
Difficult question. It depends what you're modeling. If you're modeling sea surface temperatures, for example, then all you need are buoys out in the ocean, but all over the Earth.
I will take one final question. Gentleman in blue here.
Yeah, thank you. If we can't stop the spread of the Sahara, can you imagine civilization burrowing underground? That is, we would have inverted skyscrapers, living underground, temperature control, and using solar energy from the surface to power things.
I can imagine that, and it's been talked about. But our problem is not so much what we do in our cities. I think, provided we've got ample electricity, we can manage in our cities very well, and do. The problem is food. Until we devise means of synthesizing food from directly by chemistry from the atmospheric CO2, water, and nitrogen, I don't think we're going to get very far, because with the climate changing, crops won't grow. And if we're mad enough to grow crops to feed our cars as well as people, then we'll be in a bad state sooner.
On that hopeful note, we will end this discussion. Ladies and gentlemen, James Lovelock.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.